really there's not enough oxygen in the room, so to speak, for people to focus. We often say the bandwidth of the international community doesn't extend to including South Sudan. I think it's a mistake, because I think South Sudan is right in the middle of a very volatile region. We're watching a country really exhibit some of the symptoms of state collapse. And if you were to compound that with a crisis in South Sudan, it would really make the region very alarming. It would potentially be catastrophic for the Horn of Africa. So at least part of my job has been to try and put South Sudan back on the agenda, both as a related issue to Sudan itself, but also in its own right as a country which cannot be left to implode if there was to be lack for want of international attention and support. And I should mention that, you know, South Sudan has its own really formidable political challenges. It has political and other challenges. It's in an economic crisis. It's extremely dependent on foreign aid, certainly as dependent as Sudan. And it's facing natural and climatic shocks, floods and drought simultaneously. It's got a serious problem with delivery of humanitarian aid, and the fact that it's clear that we will not be able to retain the same levels of support that we've had previously. And then it has a political challenge, which is to complete its transition, which includes very important political benchmarks it's expected to achieve, including preparations for elections and negotiating a new constitution, all within a very short period of time. And it has security challenges. I mean, South Sudan is itself challenged from a security perspective. There are at least six spots in which there are simmering conflicts, very often presenting themselves in a as tribal conflicts, but connected broadly to the overall generalized prevalence of violence in the country, from the north to the south, from the east to the west. And that level of conflict must be managed and mitigated if South Sudan is going to be able to grapple with its own challenges. So I say all of that because it's in that context that we're now trying to cope with the Sudanese war and the particular ways in which it impacts on South Sudan. So only one of the ways in which it impacts is that it's pushed South Sudan off the agenda and increased our load in trying to retain international attention. But there are other consequences as well.
So talking about the impact of the Sudan conflict on South Sudan situation, I understand you made a lot of remarks regarding this issue in your Security Council briefing. So what are some of the major consequences of that conflict on the South Sudan situation?
Well, firstly, I should emphasize there are both existing and current consequences, but there are also risks which are potential consequences which would also be catastrophic. The particular consequence, that the immediate consequence of the Sudanese conflict on South Sudan, is that it's pushed the price of basic commodities beyond the reach of most ordinary people, and this is a country in which two-thirds of the people are estimated to be food insecure. So in addition to the sheer economic burden which is now existing on top of an existing economic crisis and a country deeply afflicted by floods and other restrictions on the planting, sowing and reaping of food, of crops. We also have the drift of refugees, mostly returnees, and 93% of the refugees are South Sudanese. And we had originally hoped that most of those returnees, it's about over 120,000 at this stage, would be absorbed by their communities. But the truth is that South Sudan has a limited absorption capacity. And it may be that those, many of those, a third, maybe half, will simply add to the community of vulnerable people currently dependent on international aid. What we have been seeing, and this is really, I cite as a separate consequence, is the congestion on the northern towns, and notably Renk and Malakal, which have begun to exhibit tensions, real intercommunal tensions, as a result of competition for scarce resources in both those places. And those tensions have manifested in serious conflict and violence, most recently in Malakal, where small triggers like a fight at the watershare point can suddenly become a major mobilizer of intercommunal tensions, hostility, and in a context in which there is a prevalence of firearms, it can lead to fatal consequences.
So,
I haven't touched on perhaps the most enduring concern for South Sudan, which is that something will happen to the pipeline which carries its oil to Port Sudan in Sudan. And if that were to happen, it would have an immediate impact on South Sudan's capacity to survive. 90% of its budget is derived from revenue, which comes from the trade in oil. And if that were to be disrupted, we would see major economic consequences, including the payment of civil servant salaries, salaries of the military and other security apparatuses, and, of course, an inevitable impact on the institutions of governance.
Sudan conflict erupted, as we all know, is because there is the disagreement between the two generals. In South Sudan, do we find a similar pattern? Because we all know there is discord between the two leaders. Is this a kind of repetition of a similar crisis because of discord, disagreement at the highest level between two parties?
I think the conflicts are quite different in origin and in nature, and they will play out in a different way, although they could be equally catastrophic at the end of the day. Certainly, the fault line between the opposition and the ruling party is a significant one, which could play out badly, if the country were to hold elections when it is inadequately prepared for elections, or it could play out in response to one of the conflicts that have erupted over the last year or two in any one of the six spots that I've referred to. So it's an ever-present fault line which could lead to further conflict. Now, both the leaders have really committed to doing whatever is necessary to avoid a resumption of war. But, of course, bear in mind that this is a country which has had two civil wars in a decade from its coming into being as the world's youngest country.
So in Sudan, the conflict erupted when they did have disagreements mostly on the issue of election or in the process of that election. And South Sudan have the same issue and is going to have its election. Can we or do we or have we learned any lessons that we might be cautious in dealing with this kind of election in order to avoid this kind of sudden eruption of bitterness between the leaders? And then we see the most catastrophic consequences for the country.
So the country has its particular fault line, which we've discussed, but it also has ethnic and tribal fault lines, regional conflicts, and it has histories of conflict which have given rise to cyclical violence based on revenge. But I would share with you what the literature reveals. The literature reveals statistically that elections is one of those events most likely to precipitate a resumption of violence. But that's not the complete story. It's also shown that elections can be a nation-building event if there's adequate preparation, if the political leadership is demonstrated, if the elections are used as a moment to develop common purpose, a development of an understanding of shared values, of patriotism, of an understanding that all of the people of South Sudan are in the boat together and need to find a way of living together. So it's very important that there is adequate preparation for the elections, developments of codes of conduct, developments of ways of behaving during a robust political competition, which will strengthen the country, make it more resilient. Or, on the other hand, as you've suggested, is also a possibility, render it vulnerable to further division, fragmentation, and conflict.
On the news, we don't hear a similar pattern of disagreements sometimes could have turned into a real conflict in terms of armed struggle between the two leaders in South Sudan anymore. So what is the status quo between the collaboration between the President Kiir and Mr. Macha?
Well, there are examples of collaboration, and the fact of the matter is that Dr. Mishas is a member of government. He's the first vice president, and there's inevitably a level of collaboration and integration which has taken place, at least at the executive and legislative level. But there are also indications of lack of trust, which I think all commentators recognize and would suggest needs to be dealt with, promoted, a degree of an understanding of what the country needs and the ability to recognize that the future has to hold out some promise for everyone, a promise of a new beginning, promise of prosperity or development in the future. We have to be realistic. It's a country which is seriously challenged in many respects, but it's also a country with enormous resources, which everyone stands to benefit from if they can live in a stable and democratic South Sudan.
On the humanitarian front, we always know that the appeals for the humanitarian assistance is always, for most of the time, underfunded. So how is the humanitarian assistance contribution for South Sudan?
Well, currently the position is very unfortunate. I'm told by my colleagues in OCHA that the humanitarian appeal is only 20% funded, as opposed to the 50% funding that would have been expected based on last year's contributions, which indicates that the pot or the pool of aid money has globally shrunk, but that also South Sudan will particularly find it difficult to find to achieve the same levels of support that it has historically enjoyed. And this is coming at a time in which, as I mentioned, it's enduring a combination of economic and climatic shocks.